You're listening to Wheelationships.
Well, we're going to continue our series this morning on the power of words. If you've been with us through the beginning, we've laid some foundation. We talked about the three lies that Satan wants every Christian to believe. And then last week, Tim began the 10 symptoms of a sick tongue. And there's a whole lot of self-examination and evaluation that needs to go through. I know as I ended the class last week, I told Tim, the things that he talked about, he covered six symptoms. They're so common in our culture. It's so easy to find them kind of slipping into your life, not really realizing you're doing it, or even realizing the ramifications of what God says about having those things in your life. So it was very sobering to kind of ponder some of those things. If you weren't here, I encourage you to go and listen to the podcast. I'm going to real quickly hit some of the titles. I'm not going to explain. And so many of them had some layers to them. There were more to it than what you maybe just saw right on the surface. But what he covered last week, symptom number one was telling an untruth. And that covered some areas that you would expect just by listening to the name, some areas that maybe you might not expect. But what really hit me was a summary point. That's what I grabbed. And he said, when you tell the truth, you're honoring God, who is truth. And when you tell an untruth, whether you think it's an outright lie or maybe just an alternative version of the truth, you have left the throne of God and you are now worshiping at the throne of Satan. That's pretty serious business. And then symptom number two was stirring up discord. When we use our words, our mouths, to cast doubt, raise speculation, conjecture, to draw attention to an issue, a person, or a situation, planting those little seeds of discord. And Tim reminded us there that God paid the ultimate price to bring people together. He doesn't take kindly when we use our words to try to bring discord and to bring separation of any kind. Symptom number three was dishing the dirt. He gave some very good definitions of what it is to gossip, some little indicators to tell whether you are prone to gossip or maybe already have that habit in your life. Symptom number four was passing along false information. Slander was in that area, but it wasn't just slander. We may not write out slander someone, but sometimes we have found we've passed along information. We find out later that information wasn't accurate. But in all reality, if you weren't first guilty of symptom number three, you wouldn't have fallen into the trap of symptom number four. So be careful there. Symptom number five was breaking confidences. This is the most intimate form of gossip because it's firsthand information you were told personally. And the comment that he made last week that made me kind of go, ooh, was when he said, if you find yourself saying, well, I really shouldn't say anything, so don't repeat this to anybody, then you are trusting that the person you are telling is more honorable than you have just been. So keep that in mind. Last symptom he covered was symptom number six, speaking curses instead of blessings. And he defined for us biblically what it really means when we say we're speaking curses. It's not the little cartoon voodoo doll you may think, but he gave a very good, very clear definition of what that is. And the very sobering scripture that he included there was Psalms 109, 17 and 18, where he said, as he loved cursing, so let it come to him. As he did not delight in blessing, so let that be far from him. As he clothed himself with cursing as his garment, so let it enter his body like water and like oil to his bones. I don't know about you, but I do not want to be the person that psalmist is describing, that the cursings are flowing through my body like water and I'm wearing them like a garment and blessings are far from me. The power of your words at work, you need to guard your tongue. All right, so take a deep breath. We have three more symptoms to go. Four more symptoms to go. Sorry about that. Yes, you're right. Four more symptoms to cover. Symptom number seven, using God's name in vain. Now, this is the symptom of a sick tongue that is such a big deal to God. He put it in his top 10 list. One of his commandments. Exodus 27 says, "Do not misuse the name of the Lord your God. The Lord will not let you go unpunished if you misuse his name." That is a really strong statement. I don't know if you have ever realized the severity of that statement, but it's a pretty strong statement. God takes the endorsement of his name quite seriously. You see celebrities all the time. "I didn't give you permission to use my name. I didn't give you permission to use my image." God takes his name quite seriously, and you need to be very careful how you are using the name of God in your speech. There are two ways that we do this. One way is pretty common. You're probably already familiar with it if you've been in church any length of time. Second one, maybe not so much. The first way we use God's name in vain is as a curse word or a casual slang word that you're just kind of throwing about. Unfortunately, it's all too common in our culture. We hear it all the time, but we can't stand there and point at those unbelievers, because I hear it around here an awful lot. Guard your tongue. God takes using his name in vain very seriously. The second way that we can take the Lord's name in vain: to do something in vain is to do it in a self-serving manner. And when you use God's name for self-serving purposes, you are taking the Lord's name in vain. For example, if you use the phrase, "Well, God told me," with self-serving intent, you need to be careful, because you are misusing the Lord's name. In an attempt to persuade someone to think a certain way or do a certain thing, you kind of stick the name of God in there, as maybe it'll carry it a little bit more weight so you can have whatever it is that you're trying to get accomplished there. You need to be very careful not to invoke God's name so it'll carry more weight. If God said it, his word proves it, by all means, you can use God's told me or God said, because that's the way it is. But if you're just trying to justify your decisions or justify your choices, "Well, God told me to do that," then you need to be very, very careful, because you are breaking one of his commandments. And God has some really strong words to say about people who do that, who say God said and he never said. In Ezekiel 13, I don't think I put the reference there in your notes, but the chapter begins with, in chapter 13 of Ezekiel, of saying, "Woe to the one who does this." Another version says, "Destruction will come upon the one who does this." And then there's some things that are listed. And one of the things that's listed, it's listed in Ezekiel 13:7. It's repeated again in 22:28, where it says, "If you say God said and God never said it, then woe to you." And I don't know about you, but I do not want to be on the receiving end of one of God's woes, because I'm pretty sure that's not going to be any fun at all. It says, "Destruction will come to you." Be careful. Don't use God's name in a vainful way. Here's another one. Single guy at church, has an eye on a girl, been kind of pursuing her, maybe trying to strike up some interest, get her as interested in him as he is in her. And he, with all sincerity, uses this to hopefully, his trump card, seal the deal: "God told me you were the one I was going to marry." And you know, you may kind of snicker, but I'm telling you, I've seen it happen on more than one occasions from both genders. "That's the one God told me I'm going to marry." Now, God can do that. I don't know how many of you know my story with Tim. Before we were ever interested in each other, before we had gone on our first date, I knew that I knew that I knew God had said, "That's the man I'm going to marry." I didn't tell a soul. Wrote it in my journal, but I didn't tell a soul. If God has told you something like that, then be quiet and let God tell the person. Otherwise, you may mess things up. If God wants that person to know, if that's really from God, then God will tell the other person just as he has told you. You need to be silent and don't use God's name for vainful or selfish purposes.
Can I interrupt a second?
Yeah.
There's one other way. There's one other way that we can use God's name in vain in a self-serving way. And it just occurred to me, I had been thinking about this earlier and I forgot to talk to her about it. When, if you have a business and you go forward with, "I'm a Christian businessman," and you're using that in vain, and you're not living up to being a Christ follower, you're using his name in a self-serving way.
True. That's a good point.
Yep.
Yeah. All right. So that's symptom number 7. Symptom number 8 is spewing sewer speech. Now, I'm curious. I'm going to go off track just a little bit with this point. I had a little bit too much fun driving this one home, so we're going to divert just a little bit. How many of you, especially if you were raised in a morally aware home where, you know, things mattered, was there a TV show that you were not allowed to watch as a kid because of its content?
We only had radio.
Just radio? What was a show you were not allowed to watch when you were growing up? Do what? Right. That's why I use that word immoral, because there are lots of Christian, I mean, I shouldn't say that. There are homes that are not Christian homes, but they're very morally conscious. Right, right. Anybody else had something you were not allowed to watch as a kid?
Laugh-In.
I know. In my house, we were not allowed to watch Bewitched. That was one of them. As we got a little bit older, I thought the one that I kind of made me laugh when I was thinking about it is we were not allowed to watch Three's Company. Come and knock on our door. Nobody was knocking on our door because we were not allowed to watch that show. Well, you know what? Later, when I was in college, I came home and my mama was watching that show. I said, we weren't allowed to watch that growing up. But my point is that shows that seemed highly inappropriate 10, 20, 30 years ago seem so tame compared to today's standards. They don't seem that big of a deal at all. Our culture's become so desensitized that it's all but thrown off restraint and boundaries, where obscenities and sexual innuendo are concerned, where our television, our movies, and our music is concerned. So did a little bit of research this week. My intent is to be very sensitive to you. I really struggled with how to communicate some of this because I don't want to put the thought of a word in your mind, but I don't know how else to communicate this. So I apologize if it bothers you at all, and I'm trying very, very carefully to be sensitive as I communicate this. But there was a study done in 2010 that showed the frequency and harshness of profanity used in primetime television. So they studied those years, 2005, 2010, and they saw that there was an increase of almost nearly 70% across the board in the areas of profanities, obscenities, sexual innuendo. It's a huge jump when you consider in 2005, there were six primetime major television networks, and in 2010, there were only five. So we had one less network, a jump of 70% in those areas. Across all networks, the bleeped or muted F word occurred 11 times in 2005. It occurred 276 times in 2010. That's a 2,409% jump from 2005 to 2010. In the family hour alone, which is considered the 8 o'clock television hour, that same word was bleeped 10 times in 2005, 111 times in 2010. The S word occurred in the family hour 11 times in 2005, 95 times in 2010. Sexual references increased 90% during the family hour. And Fox Network alone had an increase in their profanity of 269% during all primetime television show hours. One of the articles that I read on the subject this week closed with this statement. It said, this is evidence that the networks are trying to push the content with respect to foul language because they now feel they have a free license to do so. So let's leave television a minute and go to the movie theater. In 1939, when Gone with the Wind was released and Scarlett O'Hara was lamenting, where shall I go? What shall I do? And Rhett Butler responded with his now famous line, which was considered very shocking in that day, by the standards of that day. In fact, I read another article that said rumor had it the producer was fined $5,000 for the use of that one profanity in Rhett Butler's exiting line. Fast forward to 2011. Let's take a peek at two very well-attended popular movies last year. The Bridesmaid. It had 70 obscenities, which included the use of the F word 23 times. One of the highest grossing, it was gross, but grossing movies of 2011 was Hangover 2. There were 122 obscenities, and 100 of those 122 obscenities was the F word that was used. My, how things have changed since Gone with the Wind. Just a matter of a few short decades. Here's my big soapbox, and it's going to be short. I'll jump on and jump right off. There is no excuse, especially in my mind, for a Christian to attend a movie laced with obscenities and then leave and go, well, I didn't know there was going to be that kind of language in that movie. There are at least three websites that I can think of that will give you very specific, that's where I got mine, details on what's going to be in a movie, if that matters to you. That might not matter to you. It matters to me. That's, standards can be different from home to home, I get that, but be cautious of what you're listening to. So I'm jumping off, sorry about that. Anybody ever hear of the story Dad's Brownies, been around since about 2001? You ever hear this one before? Well, there's this father, he had three teenagers, and the teens had this movie they wanted to see. Now, in this particular home, the standard was no PG-13, no R, but there was a movie that they wanted to see, and they got their arguments together to present to Dad. So they made a list of their pros and cons, and they said, Dad, here's the cons. There are only three swear words. The only violence in the whole movie is a building exploding. You see that on TV all the time. The only sexual content there was is the implied sex of a couple, but it was off screen. You couldn't see it, and you didn't see what was happening. The pros are that it's a very popular movie. It's a blockbuster. Everybody's going to go see it. It's going to be talked about. We're going to feel left out when all our friends are discussing it. It has a great story. It has a terrific plot. There's adventure. There's suspense. There's special effects. It's got the most talented actors in Hollywood, and it's up for all kinds of awards. So the father listened to them, knew they had really put a lot of effort and work into their argument, and he said, all right, I'll tell you what, give me a day to think about it, and then I'll give you my answer. And these teens went, yes, we got him. He's thinking about it. We probably convinced him. We did so good. So the next day he calls his teenagers into the room, into the living room, and there on the coffee table in front of him is a platter of brownies. And he says, all right, kids, I'll tell you what. You eat one of my brownies, and I'll let you go see that movie. But now wait a minute. There's pros and cons to these brownies that you need to be aware of before you eat them. The pros are they were made with the finest chocolate. Good ingredients. They've got some special effects in them. There's walnuts that are just great, taste yummy. There's chocolate frosting on top. It's an award-winning recipe, and best of all, it was made lovingly by the hands of your own father. And there's only one con. That's it. There's a little special ingredient in there. There's just a little bit of dog poop. But it was mixed in really well. You probably won't taste it. You know, baked at 350, bacteria, germs, probably won't really be an issue. So if you eat one of these brownies and are not affected by the poop that's in them, then you go see that movie with just a little bit of poop in it, and you won't be affected by that either. Of course, the kids didn't go see it. The point was made. The Bible calls all of this filthy language, and it's number 8 on our symptoms of a sick tongue list that we have today. Colossians 3:8 says, but now is the time to get rid of anger, rage, malicious behavior, slander, and dirty language. You'll find the same warning written in Ephesians chapter 5, verses 3 and 4. And Paul is warning the Christians of his day, and it is a warning that God intentionally preserved in Scripture for us to read today. And when you live in a culture that is constantly bombarding you day and night from various sources of all sorts of filthy and profane language, it can become very easy to have those words come out of your mouth if you aren't very carefully guarding your eyes and your ears and your heart. Job 34, 2 and 3 says, "Hear my words, you wise men. Listen to me, you men of learning. For the ear tests words as the tongue tastes food. Let us discern for ourselves what it's right." You see, it matters to your body, the food that you're putting in your mouth. And it really matters to your heart, the words that you're putting in your ears. Because as we've talked over probably each week, it's out of your heart that your mouth is going to speak. If you want to know what a person is like, listen to the words that they're saying. That's the proof of what your character is all about. One last area we're going to hit under this heading, and that's the area of humor. God has a fantastic sense of humor, and He invented it. He gave us the gift of laughter so that we can enjoy it. But a lot today think that it's really not funny unless it's off color, unless it's inappropriate a little bit. You're in the workplace, and there's all kinds of opportunity to hear stories or jokes that are inappropriate, off color in some way. It's very easy to say, well, you know, they're going to make fun of me if I don't stick around and listen, or they're going to call me goody goody, or, you know, I'm not going to fit in. But instead of letting adult peer pressure control you, you need to let God and His standards control you. Because what people say about you isn't nearly as important as what God's going to be saying about you. And this is what God has to say about people that use filthy language. He says they are abominable, they are detestable, they're idolaters. Don't do it. God is going to think a certain way about you, and I don't want it to be that way. Now, as Tim said last week, when speaking of blessings and cursings, it's more than just cleaning up your language. That's just a symptom issue. That's a surface issue. It's about the heart and what's coming out of your heart, because that's what your words are going to show. Symptom number 9, habitually speaking strife. The Bible refers to this as contentious speech. Using a little thesaurus here can paint a better picture. Other words that mean the same thing to fill this out for you: belligerent, argumentative, combative, quarrelsome, cantankerous. The Bible records the following verses about someone whose speech is characterized as contentious. Proverbs 21:9. It's better to live alone in the corner of an attic than with a contentious wife in a lovely home. Unless you think this is gender specific, I've got a one for you fellas in Proverbs 26:21. A contentious man starts fights as easily as hot embers light charcoal or fire lights wood. Like most of the symptoms on this list, they're habits. They are habits that we develop. Have you ever encountered somebody with this habit? They love to argue. I mean, it's like their lot in life to pick the opposite side and be cantankerous. And if you think that, maybe wonder if that person's you, talk to somebody really close in your life, your spouse, a sibling, or a best friend, and they can very clearly, maybe even easier than you, see if you have developed an argumentative spirit over the course of your years. Do you always have to be right? Do you always have to get in that last word? How many times do you hear yourself saying or maybe thinking, "I told you so"? Those are all kind of little indicators of a contentious spirit that can go unchecked and infiltrate your speech. Instead of a contentious spirit, you need to determine to have an agreeable spirit. Now, this does not mean that you agree with everybody all the time. That's not what that means at all. You are just not obligated to correct them all the time. Several years ago, Tim and I were having dinner with about 5 or 6 other couples, and the husband and wife that was sitting on the end of the table closest to us had this going stronger than anybody I'd ever seen before. Literally, and it is not an exaggeration, every time the man opened his mouth to tell a story, give a comment, his wife jumped in, interrupted, corrected, you know, made tweaks in what he didn't get right, you know, what he missed out, what he left out, what he got wrong. It drove us nuts. I'm telling you, it is all I could do to keep from crawling across that table and shoving an apple in her mouth just so he could finish something from beginning to end without her stepping in and correcting him. Now, unless you're filling out a police report, I couldn't think of any other example except that one, no one appointed you guardian of all truth and accuracy. It's not your job to correct everyone, so be careful in that area. All right, you doing all right? You hanging with me? Symptom number 10, last one, spreading pessimism. This is the last of our deadly sicknesses of the tongue, but probably the most common of them all. We know it a little more frequently by another name, and that's the name of unbelief. The source of all unbelief begins in your heart. You're going to get sick of hearing me saying it, but out of your heart, your mouth is going to be talking. The problem with your mouth, if you have a pessimistic mouth, also the cure can be found in your mouth. Hebrews 3, 12 and 13 says, "See to it, brothers, that none of you has a sinful, unbelieving heart that turns away from the living God, but encourage one another daily as long as it is called today, so that none of you may be hardened by sin's deceitfulness." Two important things to grab out of that passage. One is the warning against having a sinful, unbelieving heart. The second is its antidote, which is encourage one another daily. How do you encourage? With the words of your mouth. See, the biggest problem with unbelief is that it is contagious. It is highly contagious, and it's spread through negativity. Many years ago, I read a book, secular book. I don't know, have any of you heard of the book, How Full Is Your Bucket? A couple of you have? Well, the premise of the book is that we all walk around with this invisible bucket and this invisible dipper. And when we have encounters with people, we're either drawing water out of their bucket, which is leaving us both negative feeling, or we're putting water into their bucket, which leaves us both with positive feelings. Even the briefest of encounters with total strangers at the checkout line or in traffic, you don't even have to know them, but those encounters, you're either bucket dipping or bucket fulling, and people are doing the same with you. It's a good book. But one of the reasons that the study of that book even happened, and he opens the introduction of the book with it, is a case study that he did that has stuck with me for so many years. It hasn't left my mind because I found it to be one of the most amazing and yet completely perplexing true stories I had ever heard in my life. Now, following the Korean War, a major that would later become the U.S. Army's chief psychiatrist studied 1,000 American soldiers that were prisoners of war detained in North Korean camps. Now, his primary focus was on American soldiers detained in camps that were not considered abusive or cruel by conventional standards. The captives all had adequate water, they had adequate food, they had adequate shelter. They weren't subject to common physical torture tactics of the day, like the bamboo shoots up the nails. In fact, fewer cases of physical abuse were reported in North Korean POW camps than any other major war in American history ever. Throughout history, these soldiers were not hemmed in with barbed wire. There were no armed guards surrounding the camp, and yet not one single soldier attempted to escape. Furthermore, the men regularly broke rank, they turned against each other, and oftentimes they formed closer relationships with their North Korean captors than they did with their fellow prisoners. And when the survivors of the camps were finally released to the Red Cross in Japan, they were all given the opportunity to call their loved ones at home, and very, very few of them took that opportunity. When they returned home, the psychiatrist referred to them as being in a mental solitary confinement cell without any steel or concrete. And the study discovered there was a new disease in these POW camps, and it was called hopelessness. Some of the soldiers called it give-up-itis. If they had been hit, if they had been spat upon or abused in some way, it would have motivated them to survive and to live. And without that motivation, they simply died. Literally died without anybody ever laying a hand on them. There was no medical justification for the deaths that occurred in the POW camps. And here's the kicker. The overall death rate in North Korean POW camps was 38%, which is the highest POW death rate of any U.S. medical war history ever, ever, ever was in these North Korean POW camps. And they discovered one cause for the high death rate in the POW North Korean camps, and it was relentless negativity. That was it. Highest death rate ever, and it was all words of the mouth. North Korean captors used four things to cause these deaths to happen. First thing, they rewarded prisoners for snitching on one another, but they didn't punish either the offender or the reporting soldier. This broke relationships among the men and caused them to turn against each other. Second thing they did was promote self-criticism. They would gather 10 to 12 soldiers together in a room and require that they stand up and confess to their peers, not to their captors, but to their peers, anything they had ever done wrong or anything that they should have done and failed to do. And again, that eroded care, trust, respect, social acceptance. They also applied tactics that broke loyalty to leadership and to country, breaking relationships so that the soldiers no longer cared about each other. And then the fourth tactic is that they withheld any kind of encouraging positive news while bombarding them with any kind of negative news. There was a letter from home that was loving, kind. They never received it. There was a letter from home that told of a death of a loved one, a Dear John letter, a wife or a girlfriend that refused to wait until their release. Even overdue bills from home got through and were delivered to the soldiers. They were bombarded, inundated with these negative pessimism. And the spreading of pessimism and negativity had such devastating effects, the soldiers eventually felt they had nothing left to live for. They lost the basic belief in themselves, their loved ones, their country, and even God. Negativity literally killed them without anybody ever laying a finger on them. If you have a negative mouth, you have a heart of unbelief, and you're highly, highly contagious. And I couldn't help but think of the 12 spies that Moses sent out into the promised land. If you know that story in Numbers chapter 13, for 40 days, Moses gave them a list of things. Go into the promised land. I want you to report back on each of these things. And they did. They did a great job. For 40 days, they went in and scouted. They gathered all the information that Moses told them to gather. At the end of the 40 days, they came back. They gave their report. They said the land was good. It was overflowing with milk and honey. They not only saw that it was good, they brought back evidence that it was good. Scripture tells us that one cluster of grapes was so huge it took two men to carry it into camp. And they told Moses and the rest of the people all these things. It's a great land. Look, here's the fruit. It's wonderful. And then in verse 28, they uttered the single word that will always proceed out of the mouth of an unbelieving heart. One word, but. But the people, they're powerful. The cities are large, they're well fortified, and they went on and on and on. 10 of the 12 men completely ignored the positive, only focused on the negative, and that's what they told the people. That's what was in their report. And if you want proof of how effective pessimism and negativity is, Scripture says that same night, all the people, not some of the people, all the people wept aloud, groaned, grumbled, and complained. And do you realize when we say all the people, we are talking 2.5 million or somewhere thereabouts. That's what we're told, that that was approximately the population of the Israelite camp during that time. 10 stinking men with negative mouth affected 2.5 million people in a matter of a few short hours. It's amazing to me, the power of our words and the negativity that's there. Now, some people justify their negativity. They don't necessarily see it as negativity, but they say, well, I'm just being a realist. All these people around me, they're such optimists. I got to go around popping their bubbles or giving a balance around here, or we're going to be all out of whack. Since when does a believer have to be negative when God is on the throne? Found this really neat quote. It says, negativity is simply the devil's language spoken by those who have his perspective. See, God's language is a language of faith. Matthew 19:26 says, nothing is impossible with God. And either you believe it's true or you don't. Faith does not mean you don't see the problem. Faith means you see past the problem, to the answer that's in God's hands. You aren't saying there is no problem. You're seeing, I see who's got the answer. That's what your heart is seeing, not the circumstance, not the problem, not the marriage issue, not the money, not the stress with the kids, not the pain with the job. You're seeing past those things to seeing who has the answer. I really appreciate the message in Mark 9 where this dad brings his son who's overcome with an evil spirit to be healed by Jesus. And he comes to Jesus Christ himself and he says, do something if you can. And Jesus says, if I can. I don't know if he says it with that kind of sarcasm, but I just can't help but do it. If you can, anything is possible. What does he tell the dad? If you have a believing heart. And dear old dad responds, I believe, but help my unbelief. I can relate to that. There's times where I said, I believe, but God help my unbelief. I'm struggling in that area. Faith is expressed when you declare, yes, I have a problem, but God's helping me. I'm trusting him and his promises. And the Christian life is all about faith. We're told all through Scripture that we live by faith. And there is no place in the dialogue of a child of God for negativity and pessimism. Oh, you all right? You made it? 10 symptoms? They were tough. I thought they were tough because there's a lot of areas there where you really have to kind of examine. You want to brush by and go, oh, well, I don't do that. But you really have to examine. Take inventory of the words that you are speaking out of the heart that they're coming from and make sure that they're lining up with what pleases and honors God in these areas. Because you know, when you do that, you will enjoy victory and blessing in every area of your life. And that's what God has for you.